We're here because we don't buy into the bullshit of mainstream culture. We're tired of the mundane, passionless careers we've been shuffled into as a result of this orchestrated debt-based system of rule, and the stranglehold on education and entertainment by cold, soulless corporations. People, yes, we are frustrated. Yes, we are tired. And we reject the pre-approved tranquilizers that are Monday Night Football and an ice-cold Budweiser. But we have to stop hiding. Stop hiding behind the headphones and the Cherry Popper 420 username. Let the world see that the resistance is strong and society is changing. There was a time to be anonymous, but that time has passed. And so the Higher Side Chats would like to present Conspiracies as the dawning of this new paradigm in the uniform of the revolution. Because bold fashion should mean more than some celebrity meat dresser frat boy in a silly pink polo. Conspiracies redefines bold fashion as having the balls to reject socially uncomfortable and unpopular truths from your radiant chest all fucking day. Conspiracies.net. Let them know that you know. Bold designs for troubled times. Hard truths. Soft cock.
In the 1930s, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt addressed the nation through a series of radio broadcasts known as the Fireside Chats. His aim was to reassure the common man that our society would recover from its troubled times. But we're far from 1930, and I deal with a different kind of fire. For a new era of worldly frustration, we offer a fresh conversation. I'm Greg Carlwood, and these are the Higher Side Chats.
Hello again, Higher Side Chatters, drinking my drink, smoking my smoke from San Diego. You know me, I'm Greg Carlwood. Thank you all for being here with me for another episode of my Stupid Stoner Show. Folks, we spend a lot of time exploring the strange, mysterious, and oftentimes just plain criminal aspects of the wild world upon which we live. But today we're going to take our minds a bit further than usual, about 239,000 miles further to be exact, with the rock in the sky we call the moon. While our school books and culture have written it off as a dead, lifeless chunk of boring, our guest today, Mike Barra, wrote a book, Ancient Aliens on the Moon, and anyone who takes a closer look at this thing will see an anomalous and mysterious celestial body that seems critical to experiencing life as we know it. And Mike Barra has done the looking for us in that new book. Mike, welcome to THC.
Hey, thanks a lot.
Well, let's start off by talking a bit about the moon in general, because I believe our moon has several odd and unique characteristics that make it stand out, right? Can you tell us about some of those features?
Yeah, I think, there's in the context of the moon's placement, its location, its size, it's really very unusual. I mean, there really isn't any celestial body anywhere that's ever been observed in this solar system or even these extrasolar planets are now finding in other solar systems that can match up to it in terms of strangeness. It actually, one of the weirdest things is that the famous science fiction author Isaac Asimov wrote that, you know, he had discovered that essentially the moon doesn't orbit the Earth. It actually orbits the sun, but in a tidal lock relationship with the Earth. In other words, the moon is actually always falling towards the sun. It's just sort of orbiting the Earth almost by habit, and there's no other satellite in the solar system that has that characteristic, so that makes it really unique. There's also the fact that it's exactly 2,160 miles in diameter, and that may not seem like it's very important to people, but the truth is it's not 2,161, it's not 2,159, it's exactly 2,160 miles, and that number reappears in different forms of astrology and other strange sort of numerological contexts. For instance, every when we go through the precessionary cycle, the 25,920 year cycle of one full precession of the Earth's axis, it's broken down into astrological ages, and those ages are exactly 2,160 years apart. Now, no one can quite agree, you know, when the age of Pisces ends and when the age of Aquarius begins, but they're all 2,160 years. And so that number reappears, and we covered this a little bit more in my first book, which was Dark Mission, The Secret History of NASA, that I wrote with Richard C. Hoagland. We talked a little bit more about all this weird numerology, but you take that exact diameter and that exact distance that the moon is from the Earth, and it allows you to create something called a total solar eclipse, which is where the disk of the moon, under certain, you know, ideal conditions, perfectly blots out the disk of the sun. And that is just something that doesn't occur by coincidence. I mean, you start to look at these things and you say to yourself, this begins to look like kind of a designer solar system, like somebody set this all up, because you put together all these numeric coincidences and they just don't they just can't happen randomly. They're not sort of random cycles. There's something actually driving all this stuff. And then, of course, that goes back to the bigger question of whether the moon's a natural satellite or an artificial satellite, which, you know, is one of the big arguments that's been going on in the UFO community for years and years.
Right. I mean, that was going to be one of my questions later, but let's just talk about it. How do you feel about that, considering the research you've done?
Well, yeah, and researching, you know, ancient aliens on the moon, what I discovered is that there's really three major theories over the years to account for the moon's formation. One of them is that it was a spin-off or fissioned off from the Earth, that somehow the spin energy of the Earth spun a clump of this of the planet off, and it was originally thought that it would be basically, you could account for that in the Pacific Basin, the deep Pacific Basin, but I don't think there's quite enough material there to add up to what the moon, you know, to the mass that the moon has. Mm-hmm. The other theory is the accretion theory, which I talk about in my second book, The Choice, and I talk about it again in Ancient Aliens on the Moon, which is the idea that planets just sort of form next to each other and in these positions, and then they sort of ram into each other, and instead of breaking each other apart, they sort of magically glue themselves together and get bigger and bigger, and then they pick up dust and debris from the nebular disk and form planets. And there's a whole bunch of reasons why that doesn't work, the foremost among them being that if that was really the way planets form, there'd be no reason for them all to be in the same orbital plane, which they are. And then the third theory, which has been the most popular one until recently, is the big whack theory, where they say something about the size of Mars smacked into the Earth and broke a bunch of stuff off. And under certain computer models, you know, you can get computer models to show you anything if you want them to.
Right. It
then somehow stabilizes in an orbit around the Earth and forms the moon. The problem with that is that they just recently did some studies on the oxygen isotopes, isotopic ratios of titanium brought back from the moon, and they found out that it's exactly the same as the Earth. And what that means is that the moon is undeniably made from the Earth. If there was another foreign object that hit the Earth, it would have had a different isotopic ratio. And the result would have been that you would see a mixture of these two bodies, and you don't see that. So that theory's out the window. And the one I favor is the spin energy one, where it was basically spun off from the Earth when the Earth was in a more molten state. And there's a few questions about that. Some people, you know, arguing that it doesn't really work because of how the angular momentum adds up, which is basically just the spin energy of the two bodies. But I think we can get around that. And the other part of it is that the moon is essentially made of what's called the light mantle material of the Earth. In other words, it's made of the stuff that's at the outer sections, the outer core, the outer part of the Earth, rather than the inner parts of the Earth. And that's why it's got much less mass than the Earth, and it doesn't have a very big core. If it had formed separately, it would have had a more dense nickel iron core, most likely. So all these things to me added up to the fact that I think that this solar fission theory of planetary formation and then subsequently the moon fission theory is the one that makes the most sense. Now, the interesting part that you really get into a little bit later is, you know, obviously after that, I think somebody's come along and made their own, I don't know, upgrades, modifications to the moon, because there's a lot of weird stuff I guess I want to call it a planet, because even Isaac Asimov called our system a double planet, not a double planet system. That would be a solar system with two planets, but mm-hmm. basically it's a matching pair of planets mutually orbiting the sun. And that's what makes the Earth-Moon system, again, absolutely the weirdest arrangement, right. The weirdest arrangement in the universe, as far as we know. And it kind of makes you think that somebody planned it that way.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, if you think that the moon came from the Earth somehow, it seems really tough to place that intelligently.
Well, you know, you can't, but that doesn't mean somebody didn't come along later
and adjust it and tweak it
and you know, create the ideal conditions, for instance, for life to form on the Earth, because there's a lot of things that the moon does in terms of regulating the spin energy of the Earth. In other words, the Earth would spin a lot faster if the moon didn't exist. Mm-hmm. It's to some extent stimulates the magnetic field of the Earth, and that's not a conventionally accepted theory, but it works out in this theory of hyperdimensional physics that Richard C. Hoagland and Errol Torin developed years and years ago, to which I do subscribe. And so it does a lot of things. Without the moon, literally life on Earth as we know it could not exist. So it's invaluable to us. And it does seem to me, in looking at it, that there is evidence that somebody's been, you know, inhabiting the moon and doing major modification work on it over the millennia. And they would certainly have been in a position to do these things and maybe even move it to where it needed to be.
Well, it's interesting, because it does seem like something that's necessary for life here on the planet.
It is. Yeah, absolutely.
But are there not legends and, you know, like the Dogon tribe, don't they have a legend about a time before the moon? Aren't there ancient writings that talk about a time before the moon?
Yeah, there are some. And there's the idea that the Egyptians came up with, where they talk about the 5 days out of time, which is the extra 5 days added to the end of the year. You know, we should have a 360-day year. And the reason it's 365 and some change is, I think, because some very, very bad, very cataclysmic stuff happened in the solar system. Maybe not as long ago as some people think, maybe a lot more recently than some people think. And their legend is that, you know, the five extra days had something to do with the format, with the moon being brought and into place placed here. But, you know, again, it's hard to reconcile that with what's now adding up to the scientific evidence, which is that the moon essentially came from the Earth. And that's just one I have a hard time reconciling those ancient legends with. Although, not that I don't have respect for those,
right,
but maybe misinterpretations. And again, I don't know enough about the Dogon legends. I know some of the other legends, and I covered a few of them in Ancient Aliens on the Moon, but what I can tell you is that I think the original moon, you know, came from the Earth, and it's basically part of the Earth, and that would make it probably on the order of 4.5 billion years old, because I think a lot of this stuff happened back in the very early formation period of the solar system.
It is an interesting celestial body, and I mean, isn't the moon one of the only things that doesn't spin? I mean.
Well, no, it actually does spin.
It does.
Because it always keeps the same face to the Earth, people sometimes think it doesn't spin. But in fact, what it does is it spins in a synchronous relationship with the Earth. In other words, the Earth's gravitational influence is sufficient that it's in what's called a tidal lock situation with the moon. And the result of that is that while it rotates, the Earth rotates once every 24 hours, the moon rotates once every 27 days, give or take. And that is why it keeps one face to the Earth at all times. So yeah, gotcha. It does rotate. And actually it's really interesting, because the next book I'm going to do this year is going to be called Ancient Aliens on Mars. And one of the things that we're going to discuss there is the fact that Mars has tidal bulges, which are endemic of this tidal lock relationship. And what that means is that Mars isn't a planet at all. It's actually the moon of another much larger planet that doesn't exist anymore. And you can prove that absolutely 100% by the fact that it has these two tidal bulges exactly 180 degrees apart, just as the moon does and just as the Earth does. I mean, the moon's gravity makes the Earth bulge a little bit at the equator, and likewise, the moon is more solid and rocky, so it doesn't bulge quite as much. But definitely
that's interesting.
Yeah, it really is. And it's one of the things I'm going to get into in more depth than I've ever gotten into before in the next book, which, you know, God knows when I'm going to have a chance to write it.
Well, there's so many people talking about like so many old legends, especially when you get into the ancient alien stuff and the conspiracy world in general, about a planet X, about, you know,
right,
visitors from a planet in some weird elliptical orbit. I mean, that was a big part of the 2012 thing people thought was going to happen. And I mean, you look at the asteroid belt, and that looks like a destroyed planet of some type.
Yeah, and that's, you know, I remember opening a book, it was like a picture book, and I think I must have been in third or fourth grade of the solar system, and I looked, and there's, you know, every, you know, the planets are all basically about two times farther from the sun than the previous planet. You know, Mercury's one, you know, a certain distance, and then twice as far away as Venus, and twice as far away from that as the Earth, and twice as far away from that roughly as Mars, although Mars has a really elliptical orbit. And then you have the asteroid belt, and then you have Jupiter. And as soon as I saw that, I went, well, oh, there used to be a planet there, but it blew up, you know, and that was a prevailing theory. But basically, traditional science has worked very, very hard to shoot that theory down. And it's actually only been, you know, fairly recently with a physicist or an astronomer named Dr. Tom Van Flandern, the late, unfortunately, Dr. Tom Van Flandern, who reawakened this idea and came up with what he called the exploded planet hypothesis, which actually talks about two planets, one in the orbit roughly where Mars is and one where the asteroid belt is, that exploded. And actually, you know, there's now observations of what they're calling super Earths, which are these rocky terrestrial planets like the Earth, but which form in orbits deeper, like around where Mars or where the asteroid belt would be in our solar system, and tend to be about five times as massive. And guess what? Also tend to be more unstable, meaning that they can spontaneously combust.
Wow.
So really, I mean, this is what I'm going to talk about more in the Mars book, is that you know, I really think that Tom Van Flandern has it correct, and he's got a lot of evidence to back it up. He talks about the origins of comets and asteroids, and there's really no difference between them, and he just basically challenges a lot of the things that NASA's put forth. And one of the things he did is he mapped the orbits of all of the comets, all the short period comets that have been observed, and basically they all go back, they all point back. If you take their orbits and extrapolate them backwards in time, they all point back to an orbit where the asteroid belt is now, or where Mars is now, roughly, on the order of about 2 to 3 million years ago, meaning that it could be, well, sorry, one of them 65 million years ago, and one of them is about 2 or 3 million years ago. So that's pretty hard to argue with. So
yeah, 65 million years, that's when the dinosaurs were apparently.
Yeah, and I think, and again, unfortunately, this stuff is not really so much an ancient aliens on the moon, it's going to be an ancient aliens on Mars, but. I think that's what killed the dinosaurs. And if you buy into the, you know, that there was debris from these planets that basically, it hit Venus. If you look at Venus, there's this deep gash that runs all along about 2/3 of the surface of Venus. And what clearly happened is that something hit Venus at kind of an oblique angle and scarred all the way around the planet as it rotated. And in fact, I think it made Venus spin backwards. It hit it so hard because Venus is the only planet that kind of spins anti-clockwise. I don't remember. I don't remember which way the planets all spin, but spins the opposite of all the other planets in the solar system. And I think that what used to be in the way the solar system used to be set up was that there were three Earths. There was an inner Earth, an outer Earth, and a middle Earth. And I think the inner Earth was Venus, the outer Earth was Mars, which was actually a moon of this other planet, and the middle Earth, the only one that's left, is this one. And what would have happened under circumstances like that would be that the oceans that Venus had would have been instantly vaporized. It would have created this massive cloud cover. And the resultant volcanic activity would have then put all the sulfur into the air and basically made Venus, you know, an unlivable hell. It also would have, in the exploded planet hypothesis, knocked probably any moons that might have been orbiting Venus out of orbit. Because according to that hypothesis, the smaller planets like the Earth and Venus should have one fairly large moon. And the bigger planets, the gas giants, should have multiple smaller moons. And in fact, I think Mercury is also an escape moon of Venus. I think that Venus and Earth and the moon and Mercury were a twin pair system, because that's kind of the basis of what Van Flandern's theory is. So we're a little off the topic of
the nature of conversation.
And it's all related. So
right.
Now, in my mind, what killed the dinosaurs was probably multiple impacts from the debris from the 65 million year ago explosion. And you know that, and what happens then is that in the bigger context of the hyperdimensional physics, the idea that the solar system is a system and that all of the planets, through their spin energy, are actually pushing themselves and interacting with each other on these higher planes and having physical effects here in 3D, and the result of all that would be losing two members of the solar system, losing their spin energy, would mean that life would get smaller because there would be less energy in the overall system, therefore less energy for life. And that may be why we saw the disappearance of the dinosaurs and the emergence of the mammals. And, you know, let's face it, people are not as big as dinosaurs. So
right, right.
I think it just implies that there's maybe a different, the idea is that there's a different physics operating in the solar system now than there was 65 million years ago, because there's two planets that aren't here generating energy anymore. So that's a little bit more back on my second book, The Choice, but
Hey, it's all interesting. I mean, let's to bring this back to the moon a little bit. With ancient aliens, a lot of the things people point to as evidence that there were once an advanced civilization here is the ruins, you know, the kind of things that are out there, the giant stone structures that we just couldn't even build today.
Yeah,
that's usually what people look at. But those exist on the moon, do they not?
Yeah, they do. And the thing is, to me, it's like, why sit here and argue, you know, about whether, you know, the ancients could have built the pyramids or not, when all you have to do is figure that, look, if there were ancient aliens, they wouldn't have just been on Earth. They would have visited other planets in the solar system, mm-hmm. and other places. And if you go there and you find pyramids on the moon, or you find artificial structures on the moon or on Mars, then you've pretty much proven the ancient aliens hypothesis. And there can't be any argument, because, you know, according to the other side, these other places were, you know, never inhabited by any advanced civilizations. Well,
right.
So therefore, basically, to me, it's an ace in the hole. And that's why I'm more fascinated by ancient aliens on the moon and ancient aliens on Mars, just as two places, because there's other places in the solar system that we could look at, too. That's why I'm more interested in it, because to me, once you find evidence of it, you know, it's game over. And you can't argue that, well, you know, the ancients may have really had this advanced knowledge and new mathematics and somehow learned it from, I don't know, some osmosis process or something. So you have that by definition, then you have ancient alien civilizations, unless, of course, this stuff that we see on the moon and stuff that we see on Mars is actually part of an Atlantean civilization, you know, some earlier highly advanced human civilization mm-hmm. that once thrived. And I think actually, especially on the moon, I think that's what some of what we're looking at is, because the architecture looks human. It you know, it uses the same engineering principles. And unless those principles are necessarily universal, which they could be, it's just weird that some of the artistic aspects of it, to me, look like our stuff. And they're definitely in ruins, and they're definitely very old. So they can't be, you know, they can't be some of, you know, John Lear talks about active bases on the moon, which there may very well be, that are ours, that are our secret stuff. But because of the fact that they're ancient and they're in ruins, then they really can't be accounted for through modern activity. So it's, you know. Go ahead,
talk about the details of some of that stuff, because your book, that's the main focus. You know, you show the things like the shard and the tower and the Ukert crater, like kind of anomalous things.
Crater, yeah.
What do you think is some of the more important aspects of that?
Well, there's different places on the moon where there's evidence of different types of structures. And what you see is really, I guess I'd classify them as three different kinds of things that I talk about in the book, which is you've got these towering, transparent or semi-transparent glass structures, like a scaffolding, that is built over the surface of the moon. And a lot of the evidence for that is in the Sinus Medii region and in Oceanus Procellarum, and also in Mare Crisium, which are specific chapters that I go into in the book. Mm-hmm. And that is, I believe, built as a meteor shield, because, you know, people think, well, glass is fragile. Well, glass is not fragile if it doesn't have moisture in it. It's the moisture that you can't get out of the glass when you form it on the Earth that makes it fragile to, you know, a baseball going through the you know, the bedroom window kind of a situation.
Right.
Whereas glass in a vacuum is not going to have any moisture in it at all. In a vacuum, it's going to be twice as strong as steel. So it's the perfect material, because it's so lightweight, to build almost like a pretend atmosphere over the moon itself. And I think there's really clear evidence of that that I show in the book. And one other thing, too, I wanted to point out is that, you know, you lose a lot of resolution in print. There's just no way around it.
True.
And what I want to let people know is I do have, you know, a website. It's Mike Barra with one R. MikeBarra.blogspot.com. And on there, if you go to the photos tab, there's a link to a Picasa web album where I have all the pictures from the book in full resolution, so people can see in much better detail what I'm showing in the book. Because I know not everybody necessarily can, you know, see the things I'm pointing out, just because you lose some definition sometimes in the printing process. But so you got these towering sort of glass structures, which I think is the overarching thing that kind of goes over. It almost acts like an atmosphere. It protected the moon at one time, the way the atmosphere of the Earth protects us from meteors, although, as we saw in Russia last week, doesn't protect us 100%, does it?
No.
And Those are in certain places. There's still a lot of that stuff left, and it's still very solid and structural. And you see examples like the Shard and the Tower, which are much lower to the surface, you know, between 1 and 7 miles high, as opposed to some of the stuff which is upwards of 20 miles high. And there's other places where it's been beaten and battered, and it's basically, you know, like cigarette ash or something. It's just very easy to sort of pass through, and there's places where there's not even any coverage anymore. And then below that, in one of the areas of Mare Crisium, I show some stuff. Like, for instance, there's a couple of craters that appear to have sort of the watch crystal standard glass dome over the top of them. They're craters that just have had these glass domes, and then there's other craters in the area that look like they used to have these domes, sort of these pie-shaped, wedge-shaped glass dome structures that have been shattered and broken down and are kind of bent over. And then even below that, then you see on the surface of the moon in areas like the rim of the crater Copernicus and the rims of the crater Kepler, and even inside of Tycho, you see evidence of just straight up architecture. You see roads, overpasses, bridges. There's huge mechanical drills and things that are drilling into the side of mountains that have these long stems or tubes. Like, looks like a big pipeline running, for miles and miles along the lunar surface. I even found in one image what I think is unmistakably looks like a flying saucer, a big flying saucer, in what is clearly a carved out hangar in the side of a mountain. And it's just an extraordinary image. And, you know, so you got all these different sets of structures and things. And, you know, it does, I have to say, all of it look like it's in ruins. There's other places where you can actually see that there's holes punched in the surface. And underneath those holes, you can see interlocking piping and tubing, and you can see substructure. You can actually see stuff that's at geometric angles and right angles. It looks like the old sci-fi movie Forbidden Planet. You know, it looks like the Krell ruins underground or still operating. So there's just extraordinary stuff if you really begin to study the images of the moon, the ones that haven't been tampered with. And unfortunately, there are quite a few that have been tampered with, but that they, you know, there's so much stuff on these images that I think it's just impossible for them to have accounted for all of it. And in some cases, I think that they don't mind us finding some of this stuff. It's part of it is that the only things they're really gonna put the clamps down on and really go out of their way to cover up is the really, really obvious smoking gun stuff that mm-hmm. people have brought up in the public forums. So that was a really long answer to a short question.
Well, yeah, I mean, clearly NASA has to know this. I mean, if you're able to see some things, clearly they have to have a pretty good idea. And, you know, we've been there before. I mean, there's a lot of theories about the moon landing, that it didn't happen, that it was faked by Stanley Kubrick, that they were tailed and closely watched by aliens while they were on their journey. And, of course, both can't be true. They can't have been followed by UFOs and not gone. So, I mean, clearly you think we've gone, but what's the Mike Barra analysis of the 1969 moon landing?
Well, we went. There's no question in my mind that we went. I think one of the best arguments just to be made on a superficial basis is, if we were going to fake it, why would we fake it 9 times? We went to the moon 9 times. Why would we fake that? Why not just fake it once or twice and then shut the thing down? The reality is that we did go, and we were successful in landing 6 times and 12 astronauts on the surface. And I think they actually brought some technology and some artifacts that they found back with them. The arguments that we didn't go are very weak. They're made by people with not a lot of engineering experience or practical knowledge. As I've studied them over the years, they've all fallen apart. And it's funny, because if you go to my first book that I wrote with Richard Hoagland, Dark Mission, what we discuss in there is his firsthand observation that the people who actually started that rumor that we never went, even before Neil and Buzz and Michael Collins splashed down on their way back from Apollo 11 in 1969, the people who started this rumor way back in 69, who first put it out into the ether, you know, put it into the system, mm-hmm. was NASA itself. There was a specific incident where the JPL press director was personally escorting this crazy guy around JPL and helping him hand out leaflets that said that the whole thing was faked at a TV, on a stage in Nevada, and that we never went to the moon, and that NASA was helping this guy get his message to all of the different media outlets that were there to cover the splashdown and recovery of the astronauts from Apollo 11. And I think the reason they did that is because what they were doing was covering stuff up. What they were covering up was the real reasons they went, what they were really looking for, and what they really found. And what they wanted to do was to create a meme, you know, sort of a cultural meme,
right?
Put it out there so that would be easily discreditable, which I think this one is, so that, you know, whenever anybody mentions NASA and conspiracy, they'd go, oh yeah, you mean like that nutty thing that we never went. So, you know, I think it was like a cover story to cover what they were really doing. And, you know, I do talk about, in the Apollo 17 chapter, I do talk about the fact that they did things like, there's a really interesting formation called Nansen, which looks like sort of a V-shaped entrance into essentially a gigantic hexagonal, quote, mountain on the moon, which I don't think is a mountain at all. I think it's an artificial structure, though it's been very heavily damaged. And they actually, on the second day of the Apollo 17 mission, they drove right up to this entrance, parked right above it, and then the astronauts step off camera, and they're off camera for about 30 minutes while the camera just pans aimlessly around. And I'm like, what were they doing right at this thing that looks like an entrance? And they, you know, there's the astronauts, they say these very cryptic things like, you know, I just want you guys back in control to know that we haven't really had a chance to look around any more than you've seen. And I'm sitting there saying to myself, well, we haven't seen anything. So, you know, what were they doing there? And, you know, they just, again, you put together their statements, and it's really obvious that the mission was something other than what we've been told. All the missions had different functions, but, you know, like Apollo 11, I think, was purely symbolic. It was get to the moon, land out in the middle of nowhere where there were no glass ruins to run into, and, you know, perform Buzz Aldrin's Masonic ceremony and get the hell back safe and sound. I think that was really the plan.
That was another one of my questions. The Masonic ceremony is really strange.
Before we go off on that, I want to say one other thing. You also asked me about, and I don't mean to just completely dominate here.
No, it's cool.
So much stuff I want to get out.
Of course.
But one of the other things I wanted to tell you is that the story about them being followed by UFOs and stuff, people don't, you know, it's really weird. I have to write books because it's like I need to remind people of things in context that they tend to forget. Buzz Aldrin was on a TV program about 5-6 years ago. Was a British produced program. The name escapes me at the moment. But he flat out said, and we talk about this in Dark Mission, he flat out said they were followed for at least a period of time by what he described as basically a UFO. He clearly said it could not be accounted for. It was not the third stage. It was not any part of their mission. It was something else that was following them for a while. And then there's the rumor that when they landed, that Neil Armstrong called in and said, there's three of them on the rim of a crater and they're watching us and they're really huge and it's really kind of scary. Now, that supposedly happened right after he said, you know, Tranquility Base here, the Eagle has landed. And people say, oh, well, that never happened and there's no proof of it. But what I can tell you is this, they did have a private channel where they could talk to their doctors, okay? And at any time, any of the astronauts could go to a private channel, talk directly to their doctors and tell them anything that might be going on with them personally. At least that was the idea. You could also, of course, transmit any other kind of information through. For instance, there's UFOs, there's flying saucers on the crater right in front of us. What the hell do you want us to do? Could you please go ask, you know, the guys at Mission Control, could you please get up from your desk and go ask, what's his name, Gene Kranz, what the hell we're supposed to do about this? And the thing I will tell you about that story is that there's no recording of this. There's no real credibility to it, except this. I have a friend named Ken Johnston Jr. who worked at NASA at the time through the 60s and into the 70s. And he's told me that rumor was spreading around NASA all the way through the halls at NASA within about 30 or 40 minutes of the moon landing. In other words, people were talking about, other people had heard this and were repeating the story. So to me, that gives it kind of an interesting credibility. Either it's another false rumor that NASA wanted to be spread around, but the fact that it was being openly talked about within the hallowed halls of NASA indicates to me that that story might actually be true.
Man, there's no question we have massive disinformation, usually coming from the sources that you go to for your actual information. Mm-hmm. It puts us in a odd predicament in a weird place. But there is another documentary out there I've seen where they talk about the code word for UFOs was Santa Claus. I don't know if you're familiar with this at all, but you can, there is some audio of them saying, we have a Santa Claus at like, you know, 6 o'clock or whatever.
Sure. Yeah. I think the actual line is something along the lines of, please, you know, please pass the word that there is a Santa Claus. And it makes, it's clearly a code transmission. There's other code transmissions where they talk about, we're going over to the hotel and things like that. And you're like, what the hell are they talking about? So, you know, there were classified projects that the guys did operate. I mean, like on Apollo 17, there was this classified project called Chapel Bell, which nobody really knows what it was. And it's still classified 30 or 45 years later or whatever it is. And so there could be references to actual Defense Department stuff that they had to be doing. But yeah, I mean, the Santa Claus story is absolutely true. And again, if you read through the actual transcripts of what some of the dialogue was, it gets pretty weird pretty fast on almost all the missions.
And I've vaguely heard about the stories of there actually being aliens on the moon when they landed, but are there any other times where you've heard that? Are there any legs to that rumor?
There's no legs to that I've ever been able to find. They actually had any sort of face-to-face encounters. But, you know, again, they go back and they say, well, we were warned off. Well, again, if we were warned off, why did we land five more times after Apollo 11?
True.
You know, it's kind of like getting in their faces about it. Right. But there's just too many weird things that went on with the space program. You know, Apollo 13 being unlucky, there's an explosion on the ship. It launches, get this, the launch, you know what the time of the launch of Apollo 13 was? It was 13:13. Mm-hmm. That's the 24-hour clock timing of the exact moment of the launch. I mean, just crazy stuff that if you look at all the symbolism and coincidences, they just can't be random. They appear to be some sort of pattern. And that's really what I talk about in Dark Mission. I talk less about the conspiracy stuff, mm-hmm. more about just the structures and the artifacts and ancient aliens on the moon. But
yeah, those patterns, I mean, they exist everywhere. You know, people call them synchronicities, but and I actually gave Dark Mission to my father as a Christmas present a couple of years ago. I didn't get to read it myself, but he really liked it. And, you know, he was telling me about some of that stuff. But what are some, like the dark missions, of course, or the are apparently the veiled missions for why we're really doing the things that NASA's doing. And you lay out, even in this book, some of the Apollo missions and, you know, what their dark mission, what you suggest it might be. What is all that? Like, why does NASA have so many occultish type ideas? Why do they do things in such patterns?
Well, the thing is that what we wrote about in Dark Mission was that NASA, if you look at it, was essentially run by three different secret societies, open secret societies. One was the Freemasons, the Scottish Rite Freemasons, the 33rd degree. I mean, basically, most of the astronauts, at least the important ones that walked on the surface of the moon, were not only members of the Freemasons, they were 32nd or 33rd degree, but they were also members of the same lodge. So that would be as if, let's say, I forget the exact number, but let's say 6 out of the 12 guys that walked on the moon, if they were all Mormons and attended the same Mormon church, and you found out later they performed a Mormon ceremony in a lunar module, that would be a little weird, you know? So mm-hmm. some people would not have a problem with that because that would be somehow acceptable. But when you start talking about the Freemasons, oh, all of a sudden, you know, it's something you can't really talk about. But they seem to be in charge. There was also obviously the Nazi faction that you have, which is the Wernher von Braun's and Kurt Debus and people that ran everything at the rocketry programs were all Nazis. And then you look at JPL, which is the unmanned space probe factory, basically, for NASA that runs all these missions to Mars. And the origins of JPL were the guys who formed JPL essentially were all involved in various occult practices associated with people like Aleister Crowley, L. Ron Hubbard of the Church of Scientology, and all sorts of, you know, very off-the-wall black magic cults. And when you get into their belief systems at the core of all three of these organizations, their core belief system is that we are descended from gods who came from another planet. And very specifically, they all believe that those gods were the Egyptian gods Isis, Osiris, Horus, and Seth. And if you look at the symbolism in NASA, right down to the Apollo mission patch, the original Apollo program patch, having the constellation of Orion on it, which in the ancient Egyptian religion represented Osiris, who was the top god, it all just adds up. And you start looking at different things like the Apollo 16 landing. The lunar module was named Orion. Therefore, it was basically named after this Egyptian god Osiris. It landed on the moon on April 20th, 1972, which happens to be Adolf Hitler's birthday.
420.
And at exactly that, yeah, 420, you guys would know about it. Exactly. And at exactly the moment that they landed, the three belt stars of Orion, in other words, the main feature, the main, the main identifier of Orion, the three belt stars were right at 33 degrees above that specific landing site and only that landing site on the surface of the moon at that time. In other words, you basically had an homage to the Nazis, to the Freemasons, and to the JPL crowd, all right there, all of it sort of under this one, veil. And those kinds of things are just, they're too weird for me to ignore, and they just repeat over and over and over again in these different missions. So you have this really strange organization, which appears to be almost, more religion-based, but it's an occulted religion, an ancient religion. And I think that they believed that they had to do these things when the stars were in the correct positions in order for their, endeavors to be blessed by the gods. And that's quite honestly, quite flatly, what I think the very top people in NASA were trying to do with all the timing of these launches and all these dates and the landings and all that kind of stuff. They were definitely trying to be in accordance with and respectful to, the belief systems that they were handed down from their gods. And it's really hard to convince people that we're not crazy. The guys that ran NASA are, and to a great extent, they still are. So, because they still do these ritual things.
I mean, all over the conspiracy world, among the elites and everything, you have these type of weird rituals. And I'd have a hard time wrapping my head around it if it's like a superstition to them, or if it really does release some type of ethereal energy or something.
I think it's both. I think it's actually both.
Yeah, and then if you think it does release some type of energy, then that's odd. We don't have, in the mainstream, there's no acceptance of that whatsoever.
Right. Right. So, but again, as you dig into the hyperdimensional physics theory, it all these numbers and all these coincidences and all these things do add up, because when stars and planets are aligned in certain situations, you're going to get more favorable energies, or you're going to be able to use this sort of secret science that the ancients, you may have, learned from the ancient gods of Egypt, let's say,
right.
That would tell you that if you, if you go to the moon at this time, if you look at the configuration of the solar system, there aren't going to be any solar flares. The sun will be very quiet, that kind of thing. That would be an ostentatious time to try to take a journey to the moon. So I think that all these things are factored in. And, in my second book, In the Choice, and to a lesser extent in Ancient Aliens on the Moon, I also discuss, Wernher von Braun and how he really discovered, navigation. And it was all related to this sort of unacknowledged theory of what Hoagland calls hyperdimensional physics, which I do concur with, that basically, if you spin something, you get more energy out of the system. And it took them a long time to account for that in figuring out how they could get their spacecraft to actually be able to rendezvous with each other, or for that matter, even get to the moon, because it definitely seems to be like there was a learning curve at NASA through the years, and they finally figured this out, and now I think it's all sort of just built into the equations. They all, now I think that without anybody at the lower levels knowing what they're doing, they basically plug in a computer program and say, okay, when do we go to Mars? Well, okay, this is the perfect time to go.
Mm, yeah, they don't even question it.
No, they just, and the guys down below, they have no idea why the decision's being made for that date or that time. It's just a command decision made at the top level, and those are the only guys that really need to know. The top five or six guys are really it.
Yeah. Now let me ask you this, because as someone who's skeptical of pretty much any big story that, spikes up in the media for a while, I'm very skeptical. A couple of years ago, NASA crashed something into the moon, which is a bit of an odd story for me. It didn't really have much of an official story or explanation or reason. What do you think was the reason behind that?
Well, I think what Well, you know, again, the reason behind it, it may have been what they actually claimed it was. It may have been that they were actually trying to, you know, trying to kick up a plume of dust and water, hopefully ice, and analyze it and find that it had water. Where they hit it, though, where they actually launched the thing, and this is actually what I end Ancient Aliens on the Moon with. This is like the last thing in the book. Where they actually sent it into appears to be an area where there are, again, these big splits in the surface of the in the lunar surface. And if you can look at NASA's own enhancements, and you can see these geometric crossbeams and substructures under the surface. And what happened was the object, the spacecraft, went into it and just disappeared. They expected this plume, but they didn't get a plume. Or at least the guys that believed it was a real experiment, that this was really the experiment, didn't get a plume. And it was like throwing a rock into mud. You don't get anything spinning up into the air. It just plump goes in and disappears. And when they enhanced it, you can see where they're pointing to something that might be the plume, but it's nowhere near what they expected. And you can see that it just went right into this hollow, empty part of the moon that has all these crossbeams and structures inside of it. And I think it might have been that they were actually looking for a location where there was more intact artificial structures, because along the limbs and in some of the higher, you know, latitudes is more likely where the new stuff, the best stuff, is going to have been, because it probably would have taken less impact from meteors over the years than some of the stuff in the middle of the moon. So, you know, it's really hard for me to know whether that was an intentional thing, that they were really trying to find location for artificial structures, or whether it was just sort of a happy accident that that occurred because of the mission. But there's no question that the mission discovered something that it wasn't supposed to discover, which is that, you know, there's empty spaces in the moon. There's empty spaces with lots of mechanical and architectural looking stuff inside of it.
Well, yeah, I mean, I looked into Phobos a while, because there's a lot of weird stuff about that satellite.
Yeah.
But, I mean, do you think the moon is hollow? There's a lot of suggestion that both of them are hollow.
No, I don't think it's hollow, but I think that there is a lot of stuff built up. I think a lot of the surface of the moon that we think we see is actually artificial. It's actually been modified, built up, and made to kind of look like the surface of a moon and not really be the surface of a moon. One of the things I talk about in one of the earlier chapters of Ancient Aliens on the Moon is the area around Copernicus, which has a whole bunch of areas like that, where there's clearly mechanical stuff that looks like it's actually been built on top of the natural surface. And it's just it's just one of those things where if you look, you can clearly see that there's been modification. And the way to tell that is to really look for the right angular geometric patterns, which are really unusual in nature. And there's a lot of different locations that I talk about in the book and that I show in pictures where you got that. So I think it's a natural satellite that's been heavily, heavily modified, but it's not hollow.
And one of these pictures that I saw that I thought was really interesting, because a lot of times I have a hard time knowing what I'm looking at, but there's this picture of what they call Data's head that looked pretty much like a head. And can you tell us the story about that?
Yeah, that's Apollo 17. After they visited this place called Nansen, where they wouldn't let us see what they were doing, and they drove away because they were on a very tight schedule, and they made some statements like, this is one mysterious place. Well, yeah, if it's, you know, I don't know why it would be mysterious if it was a bunch of rocks, but it was mysterious, you know, for reasons they didn't want to talk about. And then interestingly, they actually took pictures that from the position that they were at, you should have been able to see directly into Nansen and directly underneath this hexagonal, quote, mountain. But nobody's ever seen those pictures. They're all listed as, quote, overexposed. I don't know how you could do that, but, you know, give me a break. But then they drove on to a couple other locations, and one of them was a crater called Shorty Crater. And at Shorty Crater, they discovered some orange soil, which turned out to be orange because it was heavily oxidized. And Gene Cernan and Harrison Schmidt. Harrison Schmidt, you know, got away from the rover, went around to the crim of the radar, and they said, you know, the outside of Shorty is really boring, but inside, lordy, 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 look at that, right? And you look at it, and superficially, it just looks like a crater with rocks in it, right? Mm-hmm. But Schmidt took a series of shots for a panorama of the entire crater. So he took about a dozen shots. And as you begin to look at this debris inside the crater, you know, you can see what they're talking about. Because what I see as a structural mechanical aerospace engineer, I see parts. I see equipment. I see stuff with vents on it and heat sinks and tubing and exhaust pipes and clamps and clevises. And these things are clearly not rocks. And then, you know, Richard Hoagland exploded my brain one night in Albuquerque when he said, now keep looking here and what doesn't belong. And he kept zooming up and zooming up. And sure enough, there is this head. And it's right next to what looks like it could be some sort of broken up mechanical torso. And it is for all the world, like you say, a head. It's got, you know, a forehead. It's got two eye sockets. It's got a nose that protrudes. It's got the upper portion of the jaw. There's no lower portion of the jaw. And on the upper portion, in two of the frames, which means that it's not an artifact of the camera or the scan or anything else. It's in two different frames. Mm-hmm. You can plainly see a bright red stripe on the upper lip of this thing, painted on razor sharp. And it's bright and it's reflective and it looks just like the head of a robot. You know, for all intents and purposes, if you watch Battlestar Galactica, a Cylon, you know, yeah, it looks a little bit like C-3PO's head. And it's exactly the right size to have been, you know, it's the same size as a human head. And the only question that I have at this point is, you know, did they go down, rappel into Shorty Crater and pick this thing up and bring it back? And if not, I'm sure there was plenty of other stuff that they could have brought back that would have maybe been sources for, I guess, reverse engineering programs or something. Mm-hmm. But, you know, again, in the context of everything else around it, there's no question in my mind that it's artificial. And then that brings up all kinds of other questions like, you know, what happened to this civilization? Was there, if you want to go back all the way back, was there an advanced human civilization that the Hopi talk about? You know, the third world of man, that we're more advanced than we are today. Did they build a lot of this stuff that we see in the solar system, like the face on Mars and the structures on the moon and the ziggurat on the backside of the moon? Did they build these and use machines? And did their machines get too intelligent? And then was there a war? And is that how the planet, you know, that Mars orbited got destroyed? I don't know. You get into all this other speculation, but there's no question in my mind that this thing is real. And I recently put up a couple of YouTube videos just sort of going back over how simple it is to enhance this this picture of Data's head, these two pictures. Actually, there's four or five different frames. And, you know, there's people claiming the red stripe's not there, that we've fabricated it. And it's right there on NASA's own data, NASA's own scan. So, you know, nonsense. So how does something end up on the surface of the moon with paint on it, you know, that's not artificial?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, it all seems so epic, and these stories are so wild about aliens coming here and there being giant wars in the sky and potentially wars on the moon. And then you go to your 9-to-5 job and you're like, oh, none of that happened. It just
Well, yeah, but I mean, I'll just tell you that, you know, I firmly believe, and this is why I write about these subjects, that the real history of the human race, the real history of this planet, and a lot of the things we've been led to believe over the last 2,000 to 3,000 years are just plain BS. And it's time for us to sort of wake up and face the reality of who we are, where we came from, and embrace our destiny, whatever that might be.
Amen, man. And we are getting kind of close to the end of the hour, but you referenced your other book, The Choice, a little bit, and from what I know, that book seems to be a little bit about December 21st, 2012. I mean, being 2 months out from there, do you think we are in the midst of a new age? Did that go down the way you expected?
It did. In fact, basically what's been going on is specifically the stuff that I predicted in the book, which is that, you know, alignments of planets and eclipses were going to create changes in our consciousness and political instability. We had an eclipse on December 21st, 2010, precisely 2 years before the end of the Mayan calendar, which I do not consider it to be a coincidence. Again, I think this has been arranged. The calendar was arranged around it. Or again, this is all calculated. And right after that, we had, you know, the Arab uprisings and all the things going on there. And I think we're in a pattern of shift that I argue in the book is probably going to go on till at least 2023 while we work out a whole bunch of stuff. And the things we're going to work out is new political structures, new hierarchical structures of all kinds, including religious, and new monetary structures. And, you know, we continue to hear rumors about global currency resets and things that are going on that may sort of create an entirely new perspective on money and finance and how things are done. I mean, there's a lot of stuff out there that people don't know about the way the financial system really works.
That's an understatement.
That if they did, and you probably know what some of these are, if they did know, if they were really consciously aware of it, there would be a revolution. So it's there'd be a lot of people lined up against the wall. Let's put it that way.
Right. Yeah. Well, there's even a George Bush Senior quote where he says, if the people really knew what we've done, they'd drag us out into the streets and lynch us.
Yeah.
And he says it himself, but, you know, he feels so confident because it's all veiled so well. And my last guest, actually, his name is Jacques Fresco. He's involved in something called the Venus Project, which is a resource-based economy, a moneyless society. And his theory is that we won't ever get over some of these problems we really have until we get past currency altogether. We need to evolve beyond currency because with it, you know, you're in a situation where you can't really ever trust someone fully who's trying to get money from you, and then everybody's trying to get money from you. So
it
creates a system that's very inefficient.
Well, you know, I don't know that I agree with that because I think you still have to have human ambition. The truth is, if we were all rich and there was no need to improve yourself or desire to improve your circumstances, then who's going to dig the ditches and who's going to do the manual labor and who's going to be the pet sitters? You know, it's like, I don't think a system like that, I don't think we're ready for a system like that. But what needs to happen, I believe in capitalism, absolutely. What I don't believe in is central banks, the Federal Reserve, the way the capitalism has been stolen. And, you know, Jesus said it 2,000 years ago, and really, as far as I'm concerned, the Bible is a manual of commerce. It's a commercial manual for how you are to deal with your fellow man. And, you know, we're not supposed to have any debts. All of our debts were forgiven 2,000 years ago. And those are our spiritual debts and our financial debts. And we have allowed these, you know, banksters, which is the popular word, to come along and create systems where they convinced us that we were debtors. In fact, none of us should ever be in debt. So I think you can have a monetary system, a system of fair exchange, where, you know, if I want to make something for $1 and sell it for $2 and you want to buy it, I see nothing wrong with that. That's a fair exchange. What's happened in our system is there's so much fraud in it. There's so much defrauding of people going on. Yeah. That's the problem, and that's all the courts and the banks and the corporations and the government's agencies, many of which are actually corporations themselves.
That's the thing.
All conspiring.
Well, do you think you can keep capitalism intact and keep the structure of a corporation? Because it seems like the greed and the conniving actions are really built into capitalism. Because if it's more profitable to make cheaper food and give people shit food, you know, you're going to do it. And I feel like those things are built into the system.
Well, but what you have to have is the way natural law is supposed to work is that you've got, you know, God, man, governments and corporations. And what's happened is that corporations and governments have become intertwined and interrelated and they're working together. It used to be that, you know, that government didn't really have much to do except protect the people, which is what it's supposed to do in our country.
Right.
Then as government grew, its power grew, they began to extort money out of corporations. And then they begin to use the courts, which are part of the government, to conspire. And what you've got now is you've got a situation where you've got the corporations, the governmental corporations, the parts of the government that are not corporations, and the courts all conspiring to extort money from the people. And that system has to be broken. And the people that broke those, you know, common laws and all those things need to be removed. And, you know, it's going to come as quite a shock to a lot of lawyers that they actually, you know, owe their allegiance to the British Crown and not to the United States. And it's going to be a little shocking for them, I think, when, you know, they all get deported. But I think these are things that we can look at happening. And so I tend to disagree that you're not going to have a monetary system. You're always going to have some people at the top and some people at the bottom. What needs to be stopped is the cheating and the collusion between the greedy and get people in to these jobs that are supposed to be overseeing things and are supposed to be doing things the right way to start behaving that way. And, you know, under the common law system, you know, a judge who illegally assists someone in illegally, you know, assists in somebody's property being stolen, for instance, mortgage foreclosures, all of which are illegal as far as I'm concerned. According to common law, that judge should be hung. He's supposed to get the death penalty. He or she is supposed to get the death penalty. And I think if one or two of those actually were carried out, you'd suddenly find that everybody would be going back to the very strict interpretation of the law. So right. Remember, what we have now are not lawyers. We have attorneys, and their job is to turn or twist the law to be whatever they want it to be in their personal interest. So,
yeah.
But anyway, I see continued change for the next 10 years, and I don't know how it's going to come out, but we do have a choice to make it a better system than the one we've got, a more fair and equitable system for sure.
Amen. I mean, I do see that one of the big things that sticks out in my mind is people say that in the new age, lies will become more transparent. And I think that if you look at the memes they've tried to put out, even just since the new year, they get buried very quickly because the alternative story, the true story, comes out so quickly and people start picking up on these inconsistencies in the reporting. And then they have to bury the story because they're like, okay, let's just draw attention away from this now. We wanted to put it on, but now we got to get it out of here.
It kills me that there are lots of people out there that won't believe anything that's on that they read on the internet. Oh, you can't believe anything you read on the internet, but they'll believe everything that they see on TV. Everything Anderson Cooper shoves down their throat, and I do mean that literally in Anderson's case, they just suck it down like, oh, that must be the truth because I saw it on CNN or something. It's crazy stuff. So, remember the age of Pisces, which we've been going through astrologically, is an age of occultism. And what that means simply is that things are hidden. The word apocalypse does not mean cataclysm or the end of the world. It means simply to lift a veil or reveal that which has been hidden. And the act of that apocalypse, that apocalyptic time that we're going through, is going to push us into the enlightened age of Aquarius, where we see things for what they really are and we have truth. And, you know, I think invariably as we move forward in truth, that things are going to get better.
Amen. Well, you know, it's about time we wrap this up. It's been a real blast. I think people have learned some definitely fascinating things about the moon. I mean, where can people keep up with you? You got any appearances coming up?
I really don't have too many appearances coming up. I am working on a super secret project, which I hope will come to fruition in the fall. Well, I'm sure it's going to come to fruition, that I really can't talk about. I also hope I can get paid for that at some point.
Tell me all.
And then I have the new book, Ancient Aliens on Mars, will be coming out sometime in the fall, also probably around October. But in the meantime, you can follow my blog postings on my blog, which is mikeberra.blogspot.com. It's just mikeberra.blogspot.com. I've got a Facebook page. I'm pretty full up with personal friends. I think I'm at the limit of around 5,000, but I also have an author page, which you can search and find if you want to just, and I try to parallel post as much as I can. Twitter, it's at mikeberra33. And then I've got a YouTube page. And again, all of that you can find through the blog if you want, or just do a Google search, just Mike Barra, B-A-R-A, and all that stuff comes up, including some of the people who, you know, just want to attack me on a constant and regular basis, but that's okay.
Yeah, what's that 33 about? Are you a top-level Mason?
No, I'm not. But I just thought I'd mess with people. And you should see some of my tattoos. I've gotten some tattoos deliberately just to mess with people's brains a little bit. But no, I'm not. But I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't necessarily object to joining the Freemasons. I've been asked by somebody who's rather famous in the conspiracy realm that, you know, I said he could get me in if I want to. And I thought about doing that. I mean, I think that at most levels, it's a very positive philanthropic organization, but it's just at the top levels that, you know, like all things, it's when you get to the top levels that, you know, ethics tend to go by the wayside.
Exactly.
That's where the problems kind of.
And it is a whole nother debate, but, you know, I think that in terms of these, and whether you're talking about the Catholic Church, whether you're talking about the Freemasons,
right,
the actions of the lower members are just a front. Just a PR campaign for the real actions going up on top. And we can debate it if it's a product, an end result of capitalism, or if it's something that can be weeded out. But it is kind of the situation we find ourselves in now.
Well, I have a feeling that we're going to find out over the next 10 years or so whether we can weed out the bad elements. I mean, human nature will always be human nature, and there will always be those that are greedy and try to take advantage. But I'm hoping that the revelations that we go through that I talked about in The Choice will be so dramatic and people will be so shocked that we will not forget this moment in history, and we will not allow these same mistakes to be made in the future.
Yeah, let's hope. Well, it's been a great talk. I love the book. The idea of remnants of intelligent life, us or otherwise, in the solar system is just such a fun topic to explore. And once you find the evidence of it, it's just that much more exciting. So, you know, keep doing what you do. I'm excited for Ancient Aliens on Mars. I hope you can come back and we can do a show on that book and on the anomalous structures on Mars.
I'd love to, for sure. Absolutely.
Awesome. Well, keep doing what you do and keep us updated with your findings, man. Have a good one.
I will. Thanks for having me on, Greg.
All right. Thank you. Bye now.
Bye
now. There it is, people, episode 49, Mike Barra and his book, Ancient Aliens on the Moon. That's a topic that can get you high all on its own. Thanks for listening. You can always find older episodes on thehighersidechats.com and the YouTube channel. And, of course, you can check out my conspiracy-themed T-shirts at conspiratees.net. Tomorrow is my birthday, so a great present for me would be if you bought yourself a gift from conspiratees.net. And we have a great topic and a great guest prepared for episode 50 next week. The one thing that I'd like to improve is the listener interaction. We're all a bit frustrated with the mainstream, and we should start pulling our numbers together. Anyway, if you haven't learned enough about the moon in this episode, then maybe this will do it, and I'll see you next Sunday. I see it hanging all around in the sky above, and I like the moon. Ooh. I guess the change in the phases brighten it up. I like the moon. It's a solar eclipse, yeah, the moon like the sun a bit. Ha, ain't the sun a slit? Sun's not so lit. And although there's waxing and waning, I still like it best with a new moon. Yeah, we're charting with new, it's starting, but the next phase is waxing crescent. We're moving counterclock, why's the first quarter? But that's only a quarter way there. It's waxing in like a full moon. Oh wait, there's a part missing. Left side is dark thinning. Ooh, I've got a full moon for you. Yeah, go run and tell your little friends. I see it hanging all around in the sky above, and I like the moon. Ooh, I guess the change in the phases brightens it up. I like the moon. It's a full moon too. Is that a lunar eclipse? Yeah, but shadow. When the moon and sun are placed out.